Welcome back, everybody, and good morning once again. This is Mark Steiner right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, here on the Mark Steiner Show. We want you to call us with your comments at 410-319-8888 as we look at guns and violence in our society. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Comment on our Facebook page. Send us an email to talk@steinershow.org. But do bring your thoughts to the airwaves, if you can, at 410-319-8888. We are joined by Dr. Natasha Pratt-Harris, who is Associate Professor of Criminal Justice and Criminal Justice Coordinator in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at Morgan State University. Dr. Furman de Brabrander, who is Professor of Philosophy at the Maryland Institute College of Art and author of the book, Do Guns Make Us Free? Democracy and Armed Society. And Mark Fulman joins us for this first part of the program, National Affairs Editor for Mother Jones Magazine. And welcome all three of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So let's begin here. And Mark, are you there with us? Okay, we haven't found him yet. Okay, so let's just begin with the two of us, three of us. And you all out there, 410-319-8888. So whenever these mass shootings take place, and there have been a number of them, as the president has asked the press to do, to look at how many of these mass incidents have taken place, though we also know that the large numbers of people murdered in America or died by handguns are not from mass shootings or anything else, but in communities, especially in communities of color, and by suicide in this country. So, but we do have to reflect on what the president is telling us. And I think one of the reasons that we hit this issue of mass shootings is because it's so, it just explodes onto a scene when nine people are killed at one time, whether it's in Charleston, North Carolina, or in Rossburg, Oregon. I mean, that, Natasha, just grabs you because just of the mass nature of it.
Yeah, and the media coverage that allows us to take a look at the realities of that type of violence. For me, I think about my first introduction to the media's, kind of engagement with this reality with Columbine in 1999, and understanding that prior to Columbine, there were mass shootings, but there were also street violence that was not necessarily broadcast on the media in such a way that everybody was kind of engaged and or connected. So again, it's just a reminder of how we even kind of compartmentalize these particular incidences. But again, street violence and mass shootings in this country, or violence in general in this country, is almost part of our norm.
Furman?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was a terrible shock, a horrible scene to see at in an otherwise ordinary location. And I think that is most likely what caught everyone's attention. We have terrible shootings that happen every day in many neighborhoods across the country. They don't garner the attention, but when it happens in that kind of a setting, it does.
I mean, one of the things, I know Rossburg, the town, I mean, I lived not far from there for a period of my life, so I know the area and the community. Like most of rural Maryland and most western states and many northern states, like Michigan, Wisconsin, others, there's a different attitude in the country about guns than there is in the city, which leads sometimes, A, is part of why people oppose gun control laws in those areas and have really easy access to guns, much easier than we do here that we can get at. But as my friends will always say, if you have a couple of dollars in the street, you can find a gun anytime you want in the city of Baltimore. Mm-hmm. You don't need to go to a gun dealer in the city. And on the other hand, there's a whole history of guns and violence in America, what guns have been used for in this country. So, I mean, I'm not shocked it happens in rural areas, in small towns, more than it does, these kind of mass shootings, than it does in cities.
Well, the shooter in question, he was from California originally, and so it seems that he may have accessed his weapons not in a rural setting. But one thing that was shocking was that the sheriff in Roseburg said, everybody around here has guns, but he had 13, and he had six handguns on him the day of the shooting. And the sheriff insinuated, well, it's normal for everybody around there to have guns for hunting, but you don't need a handgun to hunt.
No, so you're saying you think nobody should have a handgun in America?
Oh, God, no, I'm not saying that, but I'm just...
I was just saying logical extension of what you were saying.
I'm just questioning the logic of the sheriff in this question. They like to say that in this rural setting, it's normal to have guns. And then they say, we're all hunting around here. But this man's arsenal was not hunting arsenal. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But I would be in favor. I don't understand the need to have 13 weapons, and I certainly don't see the need to have 13 handguns to go hunting.
And this is similar to what his father said on the news this weekend. He actually questioned that very thing. How does his 20-year-old son have 13 weapons, and why? It's very unlikely that one individual is going to be using that to for game or sport. So, you know, we know that guns kill. They kill animals. They kill humans. But the more likely scenario is that they're taking the lives of innocent individuals in a college classroom.
So, given what the president said the other night, and it was very impassioned, it was extremely impassioned, I'm curious what you all think, I mean, what the conversation should be in America today. What should this conversation, how should we take, if we're living in the city of Baltimore, where we don't have mass killings, but we have murders all the time in this community by handgun, mostly by handgun. And you're seeing that surge throughout the country. I mean, Maryland can have strict gun laws. Chicago can have one of the strictest gun laws in the country as a city. D.C. attempted to have one. Congress overturned it. But that has nothing to do with the flow of guns inside and out of cities and other places. So when you look at that kind of violence, I'm curious what you think – where do you think this conversation needs to begin for all of us?
Well, I'm thinking about the NRA and the push to protect the Second Amendment, and thinking about, like, how do we, in fact, engage in this conversation about protecting the Second Amendment, knowing what that actually ultimately means. The conversation, I believe, has to stem around the realities of the number of persons who are, in fact, murdered with weapons, whether they be legal or illegal, the number of persons who are, quite frankly, using handguns to commit suicide and obviously mass murders. I'm thinking about federal involvement more so, in so much as the possibility that the ATF offers more intense or strict guidelines relative to how they regulate what happens in each individual state, or the possibility of offering regulations in the states in so much as who gets a handgun. You know, maybe more monies being put in to the ATF or unit like the ATF to address what happens at each state in terms of who has access to guns initially, and kind of give it an even kind of a punitive measure when it comes to handgun violation when it's illegal, or handgun consumption when in fact it's not illegal, and so much as who has the handgun in the first place. But the conversation actually needs to end, in my estimate. There needs to be action. The conversations have led to deaths, murders.
We're not even trying. That's the striking thing about this, is that we're not even making an effort. We're going the opposite direction. Mm-hmm. The ATF is gutted, but through the efforts of the NRA and Congress, so that it can hardly mobilize to track illegal gun sales. Mm-hmm. It has very few tools to pursue dealers, even licensed dealers, that engage in illicit activity. So these cities like Chicago and D.C. that have enacted these strong gun laws, they're islands in an ocean of these permissive jurisdictions. And that's obviously no way to pursue this. We need federal efforts that are going to involve universal background checks, even on private sales. Mm-hmm. And we have to be tighter on regulating these gun dealers. And I think the permit to purchase law that Connecticut enacted, in which researchers at Hopkins have touted, I think that is a no-brainer.
Mm-hmm. But it seems to me, we're going to open the phones here, but one of the things that makes a difference here is that most Americans, when polled, the majority of Americans, 48-52%, depending which poll you look at, believe there should be stricter gun laws. Mm-hmm. However, their interest in having that done is not so deep. It's not that people don't really think about it nor care about it unless you see a mass shooting for most of America, unless you're in a community that involves a mass shooting. I think there's not an accident that the populations that call for stricter gun control are populations like the black community in America. Urban black populations call for greater gun control more than other parts of the population, because the direct effect of violence in communities. But unless people feel it and see it, mm-hmm. it's not a huge issue, which allows things, Natasha, like the NRA, mm-hmm. to do what they want.
Yeah. And actually, I think more qualitative assessments of how people are actually responding to this reality need to be done to really get a sense of where people are. I think we get these quantitative, these numbers. We're not necessarily talking to the same people when we're kind of comparing who wants to maintain the Second Amendment right, regardless of what's happening relative to mass shootings and the like and or urban violence. And in that way, I think we'll see something different from what the NRA is using to support their efforts. Because, you know, again, I don't think people are falling asleep after, you know, children are killed in an elementary school or when college students are actually trying to do their thing and are taken, their lives are taken in a college classroom. I think, you know, there's a spin on even the research methods that are done in order to promote what ultimately the NRA and others like are trying to address or support.
410-319-8888. Join us. Your thoughts on this after another mass shooting in America. And we'll also look at other aspects of guns in America. We keep looking at terrorism, which really has not been a factor in this country. In fact, most of the killings by terror in this country have come from white terror groups and not people who are Muslim in America. Mm. So there's that. 410-319-8888. Wayne, line one, you're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. Yes, sir. I have basically a slogan that I wish you would use, and it builds on the former slogan or the current slogan that the NRA uses. Guns don't kill people. Kill people with guns kill people. They kill a lot of people a lot of the time. Thank you.
Thank you, Wayne. 410-319-8888. Let's go to Russ on line four.
Time.
Russ, you there?
Yeah, Mark, greetings to you and your guests.
Good morning.
I just looked at the guy before me. Yes, he's right. Guns don't kill people. People.
And Russ,
do.
You're on the radio because we have a hard time hearing you when your radio's out.
Yes. But guns, people with guns kill people, and that's true. Without the gun, you can't kill nine people. But I think that's a constitutional issue, and it's laughable to me that we would go all the way to Iran to say what they can and can't have, and we can't get our own Second Amendment right. Mm-hmm. I mean, it says a well-regulated militia, okay?
Exactly.
And without regulated militia, the idea of a gun is nowhere else. But you got to be kind of out of whack to believe that a constitution was written at the time of the flintlock, single-shot, smoothbore weapon would apply today with a Uzi. If you need an AR-16 to go out and bring down a deer, you may as well go down to the Giants and buy your meat because you're not going to be anything but lead. But a bullet does the flesh, okay?
That's the truth.
But that's a constitutional issue we need to get right. But I wanted to speak more to the local issue of the young lady that was shot up there on 36th Street.
Yes.
Because I think we need to understand something. And I've said many times on your show, Mark, until and unless the Baltimore City Police Department becomes an integral threat in the fabric of the community, they can't be successful. Right now, they're deployed as a cavalry. And what you need is an infantry. I don't mean an occupying army, but I mean you need to have officers walking the beat, responsible for what goes on their beat, and so forth. Because right now, if I'm seen talking to a police officer, the assumption is that I'm snitching because they know I'm not talking to them about what a beautiful day it is, you see? So we need to have that intimate contact where they are in the neighborhood, circulated, and picking up intelligence. Intelligence is critical to their mission. And if they're not getting it from people like me who want to give it to them because they're not available to me, they're riding around their cars with their windows up on a cell phone, what can we do about that? You see? So I'm just thinking that we need to really sit down and have an honest, open discussion about this because we've been talking about it for too long now. It's time for some action on this. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you. Let me just talk about this for a minute. I think that would more police stop the violence? Would more police out of their cars start to stop the violence? I mean, the guns are there. I mean, a policeman cannot be on the corner every time something happens. It's like an armed guard at that college would not necessarily have stopped the violence. It may have blunted it, but I'm not so firm that that's the entire answer here.
No, I mean, I have argued in my book that really, at the end of the day, peace in a democracy rests on rule of law. And that's something that does not involve pervasive police presence, nor does it involve pervasive arms. Both of those things can undermine the sense that rule of law is active. So, No, I don't agree. I don't think that more police would make things better. I mean, the caller's right. We need to, you know, as far as the city goes, we need to work better on the police force being integrated in the neighborhoods and feel like they're a part of it as opposed to some kind of outside force. But certainly some cities around the country, I'm thinking of like in Detroit, where the police presence has become so decimated by budget cuts, they're actually urging citizens to be armed to practice concealed carry. And I don't believe that that's the solution either.
Well, I'm thinking about what we discussed earlier relative to the term terrorism and the absence or the presence of terrorism. I think if we kind of label what we're experiencing, what it is, it's in fact violence and intimidation and fear in the hearts of many relative to gun violence, then we would in fact be able to address this the way it should be addressed. Like prior to September 11th, 2001, we didn't have an Office of Homeland Security that does what it's supposed to do today. You know, considering the height of mass shootings since 2007 in the U.S., we need to acknowledge that what we're experiencing is terrorist acts by individuals and or interest groups who want to remind folks, you know, at least subconsciously, that guns are our threat. Yeah. When it comes to persons, human beings having these items in their possession, we are all at risk for being severely harmed.
Mm-hmm. And I think, again, I was talking about also what he said before we go back to the phones here, that we don't think about what it's like to live in the midst of a violent gun culture. What happens to young people every day when they come out of their homes in the poorest communities, where they know that they're going to be passing somebody in the street who's packing a very dangerous weapon in their belt or in their back or in their pocket, and that's real. Mm. And that threat of violence causes violence. It makes people violent. It makes people frightened.
Exactly. And, you know, just living and working in and around Morgan State University, I think we are well aware of our surroundings and or what we're getting relative to police reports. That threat is imminent on a daily basis for people who are just working in this area or living in this area. So I have to be mindful of the reality of it.
I do want to ask the two of you this question about how we tackle this. Let me get another phone call in here first. 410-319-8888. Maurice on line one, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning, Maurice.
Yeah, I agree with part of her statement that people are really afraid here now. And I think that it's a shame that people don't stand up as true Americans to help alleviate a lot of the problems in our neighborhood. But in addition to that, the gun price, the issue with the guns is this. You got people that are buying the guns, they're costing them $300, $400, $500. They go on the street, they resell the gun for $1,000, $1,500, the exact same gun. Now, they're selling them to people that can't get them, who just want them or whatever. But that is part of the problem. But the basic issue is this. It's really back to education. People have no real understanding of what a life really means. And it's shameful. Because if you don't understand what a life really means, then you can never respect it because you don't even respect your own. And that's as I see many of the problems here. I was raised up in West Baltimore and Sandtown, and I went through an era back to the 70s where multiple shootings all the time. You had to be careful.
Right.
It's a lot worse now. It's a lot worse now. But the mentality of these people out here right now, they don't have an education. So they are going to the basics. Well, I'll kill you to get what I want, but you owe me $5, I'm going to kill you. You know, that's crazy. That's crazy. And these are how some of the kids are thinking.
You know, between 1980 and 2013, there were 262,000 black men killed in the streets of America.
Mm-hmm. And again, you know, the attention that we pay to that has been absent. I think recently we're paying attention when we're actually calling out those who are actually engaging criminally who happen to be a member of the law enforcement community. Now we're looking at, I think we're paying closer attention to street violence, partly because of that. But at any rate, I don't necessarily look at blaming the people. I would acknowledge that every one of us who has spent any time in the United States, we are all a part of a culture of violence. When we talk about how we respond or how we responded this weekend in Afghanistan and, you know, bombing Doctors Without Borders. This is a violent culture. We are a part of a violent reality. And so asking people in communities to respond any differently than we have responded relative to trying to, you know, be safe themselves is tricky. It has to take an overhaul of culture in order to truly expect people to respond in such a way that it's going to benefit 9-year-old who's actually in the hospital today.
Let me just throw some of the stat out. I want to get a sense of what we're talking about here. The horrific tragedies in Newtown, in Oregon, in Charleston, affected us. One of my daughter's close friends, little brother, was one of the people killed in Connecticut. I mean, those things affect people across the country. Mm-hmm. But the stat I just gave you about between 1980 and 2013, just for listeners, that's almost 8,000 black men a year gunned down in the streets of America. Mm-hmm. 8,000 black men a year gunned down in the streets of America. I mean, that to me is a shocking, unbelievable number.
That's a war zone.
That's a war zone.
I think
people killed than in the troubles in Ireland over the same period of time.
Actually, and I have a quote here for you from Nicholas Kristof over the weekend in the New York Times. Since 1970, more Americans have died from guns than died in all U.S. wars, going back to the war deaths since 1775, more than half in the Civil War, versus about 1.45 million gun deaths since 1970.
And half of those being suicides.
That's right.
Majority being suicides.
Right. But life is cheap. That's the ethos that the NRA is pushing. You mentioned what life is like in certain rough neighborhoods in Baltimore City, where you can walk down the street and you know that there are people that are armed around you. And the NRA, now their response to Roseburg is, students need to be armed in the classroom too. Now you need to walk down classroom through the halls of the college and know that people are armed as well. And they're going to spread that kind of a mindset throughout. The response is more violence, more guns. And then what does that mean? That means that prospective conflicts between people in the future are not going to be diffused through negotiation as we're supposed to be teaching in democracy. Mm-hmm. They're going to be handled by the barrel of a gun, which is what they've been propagating through Stand Your Ground laws.
Mm-hmm. We got to take a quick break here. On the way to break, I want to add this tweet we can wrestle with. We'll be joined by another guest as well after the break. Maria Strauss tweeted in, who benefits from the pivot to quote-unquote mental illness as an explanation for non-black, non-Muslim shooters? Who loses? Let's wrestle with that when we come back. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. We're here with Dr. Natasha Pratt-Harris, who is Associate Professor and Criminal Justice Program Coordinator in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at Morgan State University. Dr. Furman de Brabander, who is Professor of Philosophy at the Maryland Institute College of Art and author of the book, Do Guns Make Us Free? Democracy and the Armed Society. And we are joined also now in this conversation by Jamal Bowie, who is Slate's chief political correspondent and wrote a really interesting piece called Mass Shootings Are Not the Real Problem. And welcome. Good to have you in the show, Jamal.
Thank you for having me.
I want to just lead with this one thing before we get to the phones and let Jamal, you talk a bit about the thesis of your article, which I thought was really important. I actually took part of your article a moment ago when you mentioned 262,000 black males were killed between 1980 and 2013. And extrapolating that out, looking at other data, that's almost 8,000 black men a year who are killed by gunfire in America, which is just an incredible number to wrap your head around.
No, it's astounding. And yeah, in the piece, I'm not trying to minimize mass shootings.
No, you're not.
They're horrible, and I think we ought to do something about them. But I also think that when thinking about sort of the broad national problem of gun homicide, and of course when we're thinking about gun violence generally, the overwhelming problem is suicides and accidents, that the wide availability of firearms means that suicide attempts are more successful than they probably would be, and that there's a lot of sort of accidents around guns that result in death. But with gun homicide in particular, that really is a problem of impoverished, isolated African-American communities. And I argued this in the piece, I think the prevalence of violence in those communities owes to longstanding, you know, historic and systemic variables. But the presence of easily available, relatively inexpensive handguns does increase the lethality of these conflicts dramatically, which is how you get, you know, 8,000 black men killed every year, which is an imminently preventable thing. This doesn't have to happen. And to borrow from President Obama's speech on the Oregon shooting, it's in some sense a public policy choice we've made for this to continue happening.
So the question becomes, if you believe there should be some modicum of gun control in America, that there be some that people should have to take tests before they're allowed to even own a gun. Can you shoot it? Can you handle it? You know how to store it. I mean, those kinds of things. To the background checks and more. What that would do. But then you also have the face of the gun industry, which is a multi-billion-dollar industry here and abroad that benefits from the sales of these guns here and overseas. And the NRA as the kind of spokesman up front, playing on the fact that most people don't see it or feel it because most people in this country die by suicide, as I said earlier, in guns, or they're people of color. And people go, well, it's not me. And they're not involved in this at all.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this weekend, cover of Dick's Sporting Goods ad was the guns that they were selling. And obviously, people kind of make the assumption is that, okay, they're selling this for sport. And, you know, for the most part, we know that billions of animals are hunted and killed in a given calendar year. And, you know, this issue of humans being taken is, again, not at the forefront only when we have these mass shootings. Again, the culture is has embraced this whole notion of violence in such a way to, you know, have the president speak numerous times on issues of gun violence, but still nothing specifically be done to really address how we're going to deal with taking the guns out of the hands of men and women who should never have had them in the first place.
Or not even that, but just trying to reduce the lethality of widespread gun ownership. I mean, it is, you know, there are thousands of gun deaths every year just from accidents, from people, you know, pointing a loaded gun and not realizing that it's loaded and shooting
exactly.
Someone. And you read every week stories of children and parents mm-hmm. being killed this way. And it seems like it should be uncontroversial to say that, you know, we're not taking away your guns and not even really putting that much of a restriction on your ability to own them. But we do think that we know there are affirmative measures we can take that reduce the lethality of gun ownership and sort of a public health approach to it. We want to take them. But that is verboten, it seems, in policy conversations. And there's this odd way in which, you know, as a country, we acknowledge that there are trade-offs between all sorts of rights, right? There's the classic example of you can't yell fire in a crowded room or a crowded whatever, that your right to free speech is balanced by the extent to which that right infringes on the life and liberty of other people. But we refuse to extend this reasoning to gun ownership, despite the fact that of all of our rights, gun ownership seems to be the one that it's most critical that we attempt to strike this balance between the right to own guns and the right to other people's livelihoods and lives.
Now, I want to open the phones here, but I'm going to ask the question to what you just said, Jamal. I'm ask the three of this question, why then? And when you have, on the one hand, I mean, I'm a gun owner. I've spent a lot of time in rural areas on the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming and living in Oregon, not far from where this mass killing took place in the country. And everybody in those communities that I lived in had weapons, had rifles and handguns. They pride themselves on how well you can shoot it. Can you hit that quarter 100 yards out that I've tacked mm-hmm. to that tree? I mean, that people do this daily almost, mm-hmm. right? So there's that mindset that kind of seeps into the political ideology. Well, maybe they seep back and forth. The political ideology of America, which has to do with guns, what guns have meant in the history of this country. On the other hand, you have urban areas that, Jamal, you write about so eloquently in this piece, and others have written about as well, where the internalization of racism and segregation and poverty have led to, as what one book put it, ghetto-cide. Jill Levy in her book that you quote in your article, Jamal, Ghetto-cide, A True Story of Murder in America. So there's this – and then this there's kind of a political explosion here with that. So the question is, how do we – How do we get to the point where we can wrestle with this and address it, given the polarity that we face?
Well, if we're I'm thinking not treating gun ownership similarly to how we're treating having a driver's license.
Right.
And if we're not as serious about that as we are about having a driver's license, therein lies the problem. I'm almost thinking we need to look at it in that way. Well, the right to have a driver's license is not a part of our Bill of Rights, right? But because it's there and it's the Second Amendment, we are, ranking it on some type of hierarchy when it should be, in fact, acknowledged that the hierarchy should be that the violence and the deaths have been overwhelming. They shouldn't have happened, that type of thing. And if someone who has been trained well to operate or own a weapon, if we know those protocols are in place, and then we can screen individuals who should not, in fact, have these weapons. But I'm not sure if we're doing that. I'm certain we're not doing that consistently in this country. And leaving it up to the states is not enough. There's, again, like President Obama said, prayer is not enough. Leaving it up to the states is not enough.
I'm not sure any of the I'm very sympathetic to the public health arguments, but I'm not sure they're going to get us anywhere because this issue is so intransigent. Look, guns, they are politically significant for the people who are their supporters. The gun right movement, they recognize this. Guns equal freedom. Guns equal democracy. Guns equal self-determination. I think otherwise. I don't believe they do. However, this has been very effective. I mean, look, upwards of 80% of Americans supposedly support universal background checks. Universal background checks is a no-brainer. Right now, countless states across the country have no background checks on private transactions. You know what that means? That means that the NRA, in fighting universal background checks, is effectively enabling shooters. That's what they're doing. They're effectively enabling these shooters because they're enabling them to get their hands on weapons. Anybody can do it. Dylan Roof, for example, he got his gun through a licensed dealer with a background check. And if he had been denied, does anybody believe he wouldn't have gone and gotten his gun through a private transaction? Of course not. He would have gone. The point I'm trying to make is that, there's something else going on here with the gun rights movement. 80% of Americans favor background checks. When you ask them about individual provisions of gun control, they all support them. And then you turn and say, how do you feel about gun rights as a whole? They say, I support it. I think gun rights are symbolic. I think they represent something else to people, and I fear it's something racist.
Oh, most definitely. When we look at the federal mandatory minimum sentencing relative to gun ownership and or illegal gun ownership, we kind of acknowledge that persons of color particularly are targeted relative to those federal statutes that have been in place. Those huge billboards that many see in inner cities particularly, which talks about what will or can happen if a person actually has a gun. They are shipped away in a federal prison, locked away for those types of behaviors. But in fact, we're kind of ignoring all the threats, and we're ignoring the threat of the person who's not in an inner city community with or without an illegal weapon, and he or she being the actual threat.
Jamel?
I think this is an issue or sort of the question of gun culture in rural areas, gun violence in urban ones, all of these things, is a question of what America is going to decide to solve, right? Because you can either have widespread gun availability and then for mass shootings and that particular problem kind of increase, have increased access to mental health services, have sort of gun liability insurance, and for inner city violence, work hard to improve policing so that more homicides are solved, produce economic opportunity, decrease segregation. You can do those things, and you can, I think to a large extent, solve these violence problems, because I don't think that they are necessarily endogenous to gun ownership. But if you're not going to do those things, then you have to – the only other place you can look in terms of reducing gun violence is reducing the number of guns. And so there's sort of – we're in this place where we have to do one or the other, but the country doesn't want to seem to do either.
Right.
And I don't know – I don't know where you go from there.
No, it's a very – it's a tough one. I mean, because also the way that our political – the way we are structured politically that has allowed a gerrymandering of this country's political districts – even though it's the numbers of people who want to not have any kind of gun regulation, may not be the majority of America. They are the majority of people who sit in Congress because of the way state structure, who gets voted into what district and who represents. And I think there's a political issue here that underlies all this that I think belies the things that we were talking about here on this program. Let me go to the phones here and let our callers come in and have our guests respond. 410-319-8888. Erica, you're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm still reeling from a statistic that was mentioned from the pulpit yesterday at church, which is this is the 44th or 45th attack in the last 250 days. Days. I don't know if that's right. I hear about the big ones. Apparently there's many I'm not hearing about, and that's my fault for not keeping up better, but I just wanted to put that out there.
You're talking about in terms of mass shootings?
Mass shootings. 44th in the last 250 days. That's probably since the beginning of this year.
Thoughts from a panel?
Well, again, it depends upon the definition of mass shooting. If they're looking at issues internationally speaking, there's some data out that talks about obviously what happened in France on January 7th and obviously what happened in Charleston, South Carolina. What I often share with people, especially when we talk about school shootings, schoolhouse shootings particularly, is that, this is not a new phenomenon, but our attention is changing, I think, because of our acknowledging that we can actually do something about it differently than what happened in the 1700s relative to, again, kind of protection of the Second Amendment, but acknowledging that schoolhouse shootings, the first documented, happened in the 1700s and have continued, obviously, until 2015. It's not a new thing. We saw heightened attention and or numbers relative to on-campus school shootings in the 1970s. But again, our attention span, maybe, is kind of changing as so much as, when we talk about Connecticut particularly, people are responding or thinking about Connecticut, Newtown, Connecticut today because we're wondering, now, how do we not do something significant after December of 2012 when babies were murdered in a classroom? It's maybe an issue of attention span. We aren't paying attention in such a way to then push for legislation. The politicians that be, the powers that be, maybe not paying that attention, and or the people are not necessarily wrapping their arms around interest groups like those who support the Newtown families to kind of protect babies who are being killed.
I'm going to get back to the phones, but Jamal, let me ask this question, then we'll get back to the phones and go to Furman. If we are in a really rough place, while many in America, because we don't think about it the way you wrote about it, that 8,000 black men in America die every year in our communities from gunfire. But if the murder of masses of younger white people in this country does not get the attention of the majority of the white population and say we have to have gun control and that doesn't push it, then we really are stuck.
All right, I think that's right. I guess that would be the cynical reading. I think that's right. It's hard to, I mean, part of it just might have to do with the fact that even with these widely publicized mass shootings, most people aren't touched by gun violence. You're still sort of more likely to know someone to be injured or die in a car accident than you are to be shot and killed, however way. So maybe the answer ultimately is just sort of an ongoing increase in gun violence, and not necessarily gun crime, but again, suicides, accidents.
Let me open the phone. Come right back to Furman at 410-319-8888. Let's go to Jessica.
Hello?
Good morning, Jessica.
Hi. Every time this issue of gun violence comes up, I hear about blockages to federal funding into research on gun violence, particularly, I think, through the CDC. And that is the thing I find most alarming, because I'm not exactly sure how I feel about whether certain gun control measures would actually have a significant impact on things like these mass shootings that we see. As someone mentioned earlier, Bill and Ruth passed a background check. So I really don't feel like I know, but I would like a lot more data to feel like I can make a decision. And I think it's very alarming that my understanding is that the NRA is very active in blocking additional research. And that's, I think that's something that we can get almost everyone in the U.S. to agree on if it's more publicized, that what is wrong with having more information? And I wonder if anyone on the panel has any additional commentary about that.
Furman?
Yeah, I think that's pretty damning, isn't it? The fact that the NRA is going to block that kind of funding, that says everything you need to know. Look, there are already ample studies out there telling us that when you have higher gun ownership rates in nations, you have higher incidences of firearm mortality. Those kinds of studies, they abound. They're already there. So I kind of question the need for more research already as it is, but the fact that the NRA already blocks it, that says everything you need to know. What they get away with is pretty amazing. I'm not exactly sure why they get away with everything they do when Senator Mikulski retires. Mark, I think you should have her in here and tell us how the NRA works. I'll tell you one thing.
That'd be interesting to do.
For example, in Wisconsin, so Governor Walker has an A-plus. Now he's no longer running for president. He has an A-plus rating from the NRA. A few years ago, a study in Wisconsin, they found that 80% of residents wanted universal background checks. He blocked them. He blocked them. He said, no way, I'm not going to do that. Well, you know, look, that is not endemic of – or that's not symptomatic of gerrymandering. I think largely the problem is that people either do not have the energy or the interest or the will to stand up to the NRA. The NRA is a nasty organization. They intimidate. And you are going to need no ordinary wellsprings of passion to stand up to those guys. And I think the president is largely right. The country is numb, which means that the NRA is winning. Did you notice that LaPierre hasn't come out? He hasn't said a thing, but he doesn't.
The executive vice president of the NRA.
He doesn't need to say anything.
Who runs the NRA?
He doesn't need to say a word. Why, he's already won. He doesn't need to say a word. Nowadays, the only solution people are really contemplating is more guns in public places, which is the NRA's preferred response. So I agree with Jamel that you know that is going to be the experiment that we seem to be poised to endorse. Is going to be more guns, not fewer guns.
And if nothing else, if we talk about terrorism again, in the definition in terms of fear, part of the definition discusses politics. And when we talk about whether the NRA is winning or not, they're winning in terms of the political support because, you know, even though we experience these mass shootings and we have this media attention paid to it, we know the numbers, and criminologists know the numbers relative to black men who are gunned down and or commit suicide and or just are taken out by gun violence. You know, they have a political agenda and they put those in office to help to continue to push their political agenda and at the same time have these incidences where people are in fear because of this terrorist act. So maybe place the label where it should be relative to who the NRA is relative to terrors, you know, yeah. Terror suspects.
410-319-8888. We'll go right to Jamel. Let's go to Ray, line 3. You've been holding on a while. Welcome.
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead,
yes,
Ray.
I'm struck by the good conversation that's going on, and I've been on the radio station of talking about emergencies relative to what nature does. But however, in the city of Baltimore, we're in a state of emergency, and if we haven't recognized that all this when Freddie Gray unfortunately died, they sent in the Justice Department. Mm. They did not send in anybody for the brain and for the families. And so we almost feel like we're tying ourselves up and that we can't do anything. We can't. You know, the fact that the boycott that brought the Montgomery bus to an end happened in 3 days. And so we're too academic about this. And so I think that until we recognize that black lives, as people are saying, matter, and that we bring to bear that the families that are left behind, I don't know what the research is on the family members who are not getting the traumatic help they need. How many of them later become, you know, the statistics of either being shot or killed? And so we're at a point now where all around the hospitals and a great hospital like John Hopkins should be a point of zero, no killing around it. Because in the defense industry and the wars that have happened, there are a number of people that get shot up around these hospitals, and the doctors are much more prepared over in the war zone because of what they get here. And so there is a correlation to defense and guns and gun violence, and especially in the black community. And until we stop the producing of it, and that is our universities recognize that this is an emergency, and bring into our community. And I hear people ready to stop the commerce, or you know they stop when the stores got burned and that kind of thing. But nobody really stopped when the little babies got killed by just protesting. We're going to shut this thing down.
So Ray, I think you raise a very powerful point, Jamel. I'd like you to comment on this first. I think that about this notion of a state of emergency on a number of levels here when it comes to what's happening in the poorest communities.
I think that notion is right. Overall, yes, it's true that overall gun homicide has declined over the past 20 years or so, that there are much fewer people being killed in inner cities than there were in, say, 1990 or 1985. But it's on that same token, there's still too many people being killed in inner cities. And I think the caller is very right to note that the trauma of that, of sudden violent death, weighs on communities and in some ways perpetuates the conditions for further violence. It creates a sense of despondency. It creates a lack of hope. It does, you know, demonstrable mental trauma to victims or the families of victims and their communities. And it's an entire sort of nexus of violence that is basically ignored by mainstream America, except when it's brought up to make a cheap political point.
You know, so there's got to be a way for him, and you know that a human being can buy, maybe there isn't, or just can take this on, buy a 30-06 to go shooting if they go hunting if they wish, or a shotgun for home protection if they wish, but control the flow of weapons so that people don't die by suicide and murder in this country.
Of course there is a way to do that. We've been actively cutting the budget of the ATF. The ATF has a...
Through
NRA lobbying. The ATF has a smaller budget and workforce than it did some 30-odd years ago. Mm-hmm. So there's really no mystery why this is happening. It's happening for very good reasons. We could absolutely try harder to mitigate this and make the background check stronger. We're not even trying.
410-319-8888. Let's go to Nick in Crofton. Nick?
Hey, good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Nick.
And always, very, important discussion. I'm going to use the word marvelous, and that's not something good. I marvel at how strange a kabuki play this country is. I marvel at the NRA who comes out and says, more guns. You know, how audacious. And you got to be fiendish to come out and say that. But they've been saying that, and they've been gaining more power and strength in this country for the last 30 years, I would say. And who always gets hurt are the poorest and the darker-skinned peoples of not only this country but the world by having more gun violence, which, you know, it's bad cousins of drug and other types of violence always follow. What's interesting, Mark, is all these discussions have a tie in them, too. I heard a very interesting discussion about, the Walmart economy and how really it grinds the American worker down with the despair of working hard but getting paid just a little bit of money.
Right.
These things all tie together. And I'm a little pissed off, if I can use that phrase, at people who should be thinking better, not your panelists or you, Mark, but people who should be saying enough is enough is enough, and run on these issues and say, you know what, we are going to defeat these people because they only represent, I would say, here's a rough estimate by, some of them, I'm not a political scientist, but there's some of 10 or 15% of the most ardent gun nuts in this country that the other 80 to 85% of this country are being defeated by time.
Okay, wait, I'm sorry, Nick, we're just about out of time here. I want to get our panel just a quick, like half a minute each to say their final thoughts. Jamil?
I think that's right. It is possible to build a political coalition around reducing gun violence of all kinds. We just have to do it.
Furman.
I mean, I the last caller got me fired up. You know, I want to see politicians run on this, and I don't see why they couldn't. I said repeatedly, you know, people get so down in the dumps about this issue. We're going nowhere. We're going the opposite direction. Look, the conversation on gay marriage changed nearly overnight in the last 10 years. There's no reason that this conversation can't change, and at the state level, it is changing.
Very quickly, because we have to wrap up here.
And just wanted to acknowledge a 71-year-old man who was shot down and killed in Baltimore, and thoughts with our 9-year-old child in Baltimore who is, in fact, in the hospital for being shot. We need to remember these individuals and kind of push for legislation to protect everyone, including persons in inner cities.
I want to remind folks that Dr. Furman de Brabander will be presenting his book, Do Guns Make Us Free? Democracy and the Armed Society, tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. at the Johns Hopkins University, Barnes & Noble, in Charles Village. More information available at calendar.jhu.edu. I want to thank Furman and Dr. Natasha Pratt-Harris and Jamil Bowie for joining us. It's been a great conversation. Thank the three of you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up when we return, we look at the Baltimore City Paper's current protest-themed issue with some of the issue staff members and contributors as we reflect on the uprising that took place here in Baltimore. Stay with us. We'll be right back.